Chapter 16. Have a game of cards at Eckert, if you please. You deal. I ask for cards. I lead the deuce of clubs. What? There is no deuce. Deuce take it. What? People will go on talking about their neighbors, and won't have their mouths stopped by cards, or ever so much microscopes and aquariums. Ah, my poor dear Mrs. Candor, I agree with you. By the way, did you ever see anything like Lady Godiva Trotter's dress last night? People will go on chattering, although we hold our tongues. And, after all, my good soul, what will their scandal matter 100 years hence? Small Beer Chronicle. Not long since, at a certain banquet, I had the good fortune to sit by Dr. Polymathesis, who knows everything, and who, about the time when the claret made its appearance, mentioned that old dictum of the grumbling Oxford Don, that LL claret would be port if it could. Imbibing a bumper of one or the other not ungratefully, I thought to myself, here surely, Mr. Roundabout, is a good text for one of your reverence's sermons. Let us apply to the human race, dear brethren, what is here said of the vintages of Portugal and Gascony, and we shall have no difficulty in perceiving how many clerics aspire to be ports in their way, how most men and women of our acquaintance, how we ourselves, are Aquitanians giving ourselves Lusitanian airs, how we wish to have credit for being stronger, braver, more beautiful, more worthy than we really are. Nay, the beginning of this hypocrisy, a desire to excel, a desire to be hearty, fruity, generous, strength imparting, is a virtuous and noble ambition, and it is most difficult for a man in his own case, or his neighbor's, to say at what point this ambition transgresses the boundary of virtue, and becomes vanity, pretense, and self-seeking. You are a poor man, let us say, showing a bold face to adverse fortune, and wearing a confident aspect. Your purse is very narrow, but you owe no man a penny. Your means are scanty, but your wife's gown is decent. Your old coat well brushed. Your children at a good school. You grumble to no one. Ask favors of no one. Truckle to no neighbors on account of their superior rank, or a worse, and demeanor, and a more common crime still, envy none for their better fortune. To all outward appearances you are as well, to do as your neighbors, who have thrice your income. There may be in this case some little mixture of pretension in your life and behavior. You certainly do put on a smiling face, whilst fortune is pinching you. Your wife and girls, so smart and neat at evening parties, are cutting, patching, and cobbling all day, to make both ends of life's haberdashery meet. You give a friend a bottle of wine on occasion, but are content yourself with a glass of whiskey and water. You avoid a cab, saying that of all things you like to walk home after dinner, which you know, my good friend, is a fib. I grant you that in this scheme of life there does enter ever so little hypocrisy, that this claret is loaded, as it were, but your desire to portify yourself is amiable, is pardonable, is perhaps honorable. And were there no other hypocrisies than yours in the world, we should be a set of worthy fellows, and sermonizers, moralizers, satirizers, would have to hold their tongues, and go to some other trade to get a living. But you know you will step over that boundary line of virtue and modesty, into the district, where humbug and vanity begin, and there the moralizer catches you, and makes an example of you. For instance, in a certain novel in another place, my friend Mr. Talbot Wisden has mentioned a man whom you and I know to be a wretched ordinaire, but who persists in treating himself as if he was the finest 20 port. In our Britain there are hundreds of men like him, forever striving to swell beyond their natural size, to strain beyond their natural strength, to step beyond their natural stride. Search, search within your own waistcoats. Dear brethren, you know in your hearts which of your ordinary qualities you would pass off, and fain consider as first-rate port. And why not you yourself, Mr. Preacher? Says the congregation. Dearly beloved, neither in or out of this pulpit do I profess to be bigger, or cleverer, or wiser, or better than any of you. A short while since, a certain reviewer announced that I gave myself great pretensions as a philosopher. I a philosopher. I advanced pretensions. My dear Saturday friend. And you? Don't you teach everything to everybody, and punish the naughty boys, if they don't learn as you bid them? You teach politics to Lord John and Mr. Gladstone. You teach poets how to write, painters, how to paint, gentlemen, manners, and opera dancers, how to pirouette. I was not a little amused of late by an instance of the modesty of our Saturday friend, who, more Athenian than the Athenians, and apropos of a Greek book by a Greek author, sat down and gravely showed the Greek gentleman how to write his own language. No, I do not, as far as I know, try to be port at all, but offer in these presents a sound genuine ordinaire, at 18s, per dozen let us say, grown on my own hillside, and offered the banquier to those who will sit down under my tonneau, and have a half hour's drink and gossip. It is none of your hot porto, my friend. I know there is much better and stronger liquor elsewhere. Some pronounce it sour. Some say it is thin, some that it has woefully lost its flavor. This may or may not be true. There are good and bad ears, ears that surprise everybody, ears of which the produce is small and bad, or rich and plentiful. But if my tap is not genuine, it is not, and no man should give himself the trouble to drink it. I do not even say that I would be port if I could, knowing that port, by which I would imply much stronger, deeper, richer, and more durable liquor than my vineyard can furnish, is not relished by all palates, or suitable to all heads. We will assume then, dear brother, that you and I are tolerably modest people, and, ourselves being thus out of the question, proceed to show how pretentious our neighbors are, and how very many of them would be port if they could. Have you never seen a small man from college placed amongst great folk, and giving himself the airs of a man of fashion? He goes back to his common room with fond reminiscences of Ermine Castle or Strawberry Hall. He writes to the dear Countess, to say that dear Lord Lollipop is getting on very well at St. Boniface, and that the accident which he met with in a scuffle with an inebriated bargeman only showed his spirit and honor, and will not permanently disfigure his lordship's nose. He gets his clothes from dear Lollipop's London tailor, and wears a mauve or magenta tie when he rides out to see the hounds. A love of fashionable people is a weakness, I do not say of all, but of some tutors. Witness that Eton tutor t'other day, who intimated that in Cornhill we could not understand the perfect purity, delicacy, and refinement of those genteel families who sent their sons to Eton. Oh, Usher, mon ami! Old Sam Johnson, who too, had been an usher in his early life, kept a little of that weakness always. Suppose Goldsmith had knocked him up at 3 in the morning and proposed a boat to Greenwich, as Topham Beauclerk and his friend did, would he have said, "What, my boy, are you for a frolic? I'm with you," and gone and put on his clothes? Rather he would have pitched poor Goldsmith downstairs. He would have liked to be port if he could. Of course we wouldn't. Our opinion of the Portugal grape is known. It grows very high, and is very sour, and we don't go for that kind of grape at all. I was walking with Mr. Fox, and sure this anecdote comes very pat after the grapes, was walking with Mr. Fox in the Louvre, says Benjamin West, upon some paper I have just been reading, and I remarked how many people turned round to look at me. This shows the respect of the French for the fine arts. This is a curious instance of a very small claret indeed, which imagined itself to be port of the strongest body. There are not many instances of a faith so deep, so simple, so satisfactory as this. I have met many who would like to be port, but with few of the Gascon sort, who absolutely believed they were port. George III. Believed in West's port and thought Reynolds is overrated stuff. When I saw West's pictures at Philadelphia, I looked at them with astonishment and awe. Hide, blushing glory, hide your head under your old nightcap. O immortality, is this the end of you? Did any of you, my dear brethren, ever try and read Lacmoire's poems, or the Pics of Barlormian, or the Enread, or what shall we say, Pollock's Course of Time? They were thought to be more lasting than brass by some people, and where are they now? And our masterpieces of literature are poets that, if not immortal, at any rate, are to last their 50, their 100 years. Oh, sirs, don't you think a very small cellar will hold them? Those poor people in brass, on pedestals, hectoring about Trafalgar Square and that neighborhood. Don't you think many of them, apart even from the ridiculous execution, cut rather a ridiculous figure, and that we are too eager to set up our ordinary heroism and talent for port? A Duke of Wellington or two I will grant, though even of these idols a moderate supply will be sufficient. Some years ago a famous and witty French critic was in London, with whom I walked the streets. I am ashamed to say that I informed him, being in hopes, that he was about to write some papers regarding the manners and customs of this country, that all the statues he saw represented the Duke of Wellington. That on the arch opposite Apsley House, the Duke in a cloak and cocked hat, on horseback. That behind Apsley House in an airy fig leaf costume, the Duke again. That in Cockspur Street, the Duke with a pigtail, and so on. I showed him an army of dukes. There are many bronze heroes who after a few years look already as foolish, awkward, and out of place as a man, say at Schulbred's or Swan and Edgar's. For example, those three grenadiers in Pall Mall, who have been up only a few months. Don't you pity those unhappy household troops, who have to stand frowning and looking fierce there, and think they would like to step down and go to barracks? That they fought very bravely there is no doubt, but so did the Russians fight very bravely, and the French fight very bravely, and so did Colonel Jones and the 99th, and Colonel Brown and the 100th, and I say again that ordinaire should not give itself port airs, and that an honest ordinaire would blush to be found swaggering so. I am sure, if you could consult the Duke of York, who is impaled on his column between the two clubs, and ask his late Royal Highness whether he thought he ought to remain there, he would say no. A brave, worthy man, not a braggart or boaster, to be put upon that heroic perch, must be painful to him. Lord George Bentinck, I suppose, being in the midst of the family park in Cavendish Square, may conceive that he has a right to remain in his place. But look at William of Cumberland, with his hat cocked over his eye, prancing behind Lord George on his Roman-nosed charger. He, depend on it, would be for getting off his horse, if he had the permission. He did not hesitate about trifles, as we know, but he was a very truth-telling and honorable soldier. And as for heroic rank and statuesque dignity, I would wager a dozen of 20 port against a bottle of pure and sound Bordeaux, at 18s, or dozen bottles included, that he never would think of claiming any such absurd distinction. They have got a statue of Thomas More at Dublin, I hear. Is he on horseback? Some men should have, say, a 50 years lease of glory. After a while some gentleman now in brass should go to the melting furnace, and reappear in some other gentleman's shape. Lately I saw that Melville column rising over Edinburgh. Come, good men and true, don't you feel a little awkward and uneasy when you walk under it? Who was this to stand in heroic places? And is yon the man whom Scotchmen most delight to honor? I must own deferentially that there is a tendency in North Britain to overesteem its heroes. Scotch ale is very good and strong, but it is not stronger than all the other beer in the world, as some Scottish patriots would insist. When there has been a war, and stout old Sandy Sandskillet returns home from India or Crimea, what a bagpiping, shouting, hurraying, and self-glorification takes place round about him. You would fancy, to hear McGorator after dinner, that the Scotch had fought all the battles, killed all the Russians, Indian rebels, or what not. In Cooper Fife, there's a little inn called the Addle of Waterloo, and what do you think the sign is? I sketched from memory, to be sure. Asterisk, the Battle of Waterloo is one broad Scotchman laying about him with a broadsword. Yes, yes, my dear Mac, you are wise, you are good, you are clever, you are handsome, you are brave, you are rich, and see, semicolon, but so is Jones over the border. Scotch salmon is good, but there are other good fish in the sea. I once heard a Scotchman lecture on poetry in London. Of course the pieces he selected were chiefly by Scottish authors, and Walter Scott was his favorite poet. I whispered to my neighbor, who was a Scotchman, by the way, the audience were almost all Scotch, and the room was all Max, I beg your pardon, but I couldn't help it, I really couldn't help it, he professor has said the best poet was a Scotchman. I wager that he will say the worst poet was a Scotchman too. And sure enough that worst poet, when he made his appearance, was a Northern Briton. Asterisk this refers to an illustrated edition of the work. And as we are talking of bragging, and I am on my travels, can I forget one mighty republic, one two mighty republics, where people are notoriously fond of passing off their claret for port. I am very glad, for the sake of a kind friend, that there is a great and influential party in the United, and, I trust, in the Confederate States, asterisk who believe that Catawba wine is better than the best champagne. Opposite that famous old White House at Washington, whereof I shall ever have a grateful memory, they have set up an equestrian statue of General Jackson, by a self-taught American artist of no inconsiderable genius and skill. At an evening party a member of Congress seized me in a corner of the room, and asked me, if I did not think this was the finest equestrian statue in the world? How was I to deal with this plain question, put to me in a corner? I was bound to reply, and accordingly said, that I did not think it was the finest statue in the world. L, sir, says the member of Congress, but you must remember that Mr. M had never seen a statue when he made this. I suggested that to see other statues might do Mr. M no harm. Nor was any man more willing to own his defects, or more modest regarding his merits, than the sculptor himself, whom I met subsequently. But oh, what a charming article there was in a Washington paper next day about the impertinence of criticism, and offensive tone of arrogance which Englishmen adopted towards men, and works of genius in America. Oh, was this man, who and see. The Washington writer was angry, because I would not accept this American claret as the finest port wine in the world. Ah me. It is about blood, and not wine, that the quarrel now is, and who shall foretell its end? Asterisk written in July, 1861. How much claret, that would be port, if it could is handed about in every society. In the House of Commons, what small beer orators try to pass for strong. Stay. Have I a spite against anyone? It is a fact, that the wife of the member for Bungay has left off asking me, and Mrs. Roundabout to her evening parties. Now is the time, to have a slap at him. I will say, that he was always overrated, and that now he is lamentably falling off even from what he has been. I will back the member for Stoke Poges against him, and show that the dashing young member for Islington is a far sounder man than either. Have I any little literary animosities? Of course not. Men of letters never have. Otherwise, how I could serve out a competitor here, make a face over his works, and show that this would be port is very meager ordinary indeed. Nonsense, man. Why so squeamish? Do they spare you? Now you have the whip in your hand, won't you lay on? You used to be a pretty whip enough as a young man, and liked it too. Is there no enemy who would be the better for a little thonging? No. I have militated in former times, not without glory, but I grow peaceable as I grow old. And if I have a literary enemy, why, he will probably write a book ere long, and then it will be his turn, and my favorite review will be down upon him. My brethren, these sermons are professedly short, for I have that opinion of my dear congregation, which leads me to think that were I to preach at great length they would yawn, stamp, make noises, and perhaps go straightway out of church. And yet with this text I protest I could go on for hours. What multitudes of men, what multitudes of women, my dears, pass off their ordinaire for port, their small beer for strong. In literature, in politics, in the army, the navy, the church, at the bar, in the world, what an immense quantity of cheap liquor is made to do service for better sorts. Ask Sergeant Roland his opinion of Oliver Q. C. Ordinaire, my good fellow, ordinaire, with a port wine label. Ask Oliver his opinion of Roland. Ever was a man so overrated by the world and by himself. Ask Tweedledumsky his opinion of Tweedledistine's performance. Quack, my dear sir. An ignoramus, I gifu my vort. He gombus an opera. He is not fit to make dance a bear. Ask Paddington and Buckminster, those two wells of fashion, what they think of each other. They are notorious ordinaire. You and I remember when they passed for very small wine, and now how high and mighty they have become. What do you say to Tomkins' sermons? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.